This is the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information about the Communication Research Center. This podcast is a presentation of a colloquium given by Professor Dietram Scheufele of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at University of Wisconsin-Madison. The title, From Stem Cells to Nanotechnology, The Science of Communicating Controversial Science.
Thank you, Jim. I don't know how much extra credit you guys give at BU, but it must be a lot more than we give at Wisconsin for these talks. What I want to talk about today is actually something that related to the second hat that I'm wearing professionally, and that is I'm a co-PI of the Center for Nanotech and Society at Arizona State. And if you have no idea what nanotech is, then you're probably in the same boat with about 80% of the American public who have no idea what it is. I'll get to that in a second, but it's something that you have in your lives already and that you have in your lives without necessarily knowing what the impacts are, what the impacts will be 5-10 years from now. So what I talk about is three different things, and I understand that this may be a little bit small for some of you in the back, so I'll try and talk through it. I want to talk about three different things. Number one, why are we still talking about communicating controversial science? Why haven't we figured this out? We nuclear energy, for instance, is certainly one example of a controversial science that we've talked about for decades. So why did Larry Page, for instance, from Google go up and at some point tell US scientists, look, you have a marketing problem, and this is about 3 years ago. And he's absolutely right. We do have a marketing problem in science, and as a result, we still have controversy surrounding stem cell. As a result, we're being outdone and outspent by China on renewable energies and so on. Second one is I want to tell you quickly how we all make sense of science without really knowing much about it. Because after this talk, you will all have a view on nanotechnology. You will not understand exactly how it works, but you'll all have an idea of what you think about it. And then I want to quickly touch, just from a communication perspective, on a few new ways in which we can really connect with publics. Because the U.S. is really at a critical juncture where In a global competitiveness sense, we're falling behind, and we're falling behind China, certainly in the area of nanotech, very first technology where China is outdoing us on patents and on research productivity. So there are really some important steps to think about. Let me first talk about nanotech and kind of the challenge of talking about emerging technologies. Nanotech is something that really very often is described as an enabling technology. Simply something that happens at a certain scale. So when it comes to a microscope, for instance, that's about 1,000 times of a nanometer, the idea of a micrometer. The nanometer is 1 to 100 nanometers is what nanotechnology is defined as. A nanometer being a billionth of a meter. So it's way too small to see even with a microscope. You need a scanning tunneling microscope. To see it, an ant is about 50 million nanometers long. So just to give you that as an idea, 50 million nanometers for an ant. So it's something that a lot of corporations already use, and then let me just give you a few examples here. We're talking about a $3.1 trillion industry in the next 5 years. We're talking 20%, 15 to 20% of all manufacturing jobs being in nanotechnology. We're talking Mercedes already having most of their car paints based on nanotechnology. We're talking about 1,000-plus consumer products on the market right now, ranging from washing machines that release silver nanoparticles into the drinking water, antimicrobial silver nanoparticles. We're talking about military applications, we're talking about squash rackets, we're talking about golf clubs, we're talking about clothes that are stain resistant, we're talking about self-cleaning windows, and we're talking about federal funding that has almost quadrupled even under the Bush administration. So we're talking about something that really is in the middle of changing everything from medicine to materials to cars to military applications. The problem that we have with nano there are a few problems. Problem number one is the funding environment. And I want to show you really quickly. I mean, we're talking here really billions and billions of dollars of funding over the years. And I'm just going to show you or highlight four of those, maybe the top three, rather. I point with my finger since my laser pointer doesn't work here. Department of Energy. So a lot of it is renewable energy. Just to give you a sense of what we spend on energy in the U.S., U.S. consumers have spent about $7 billion in 2009 on potato chips. That's $7.1 billion. We spend about $5 to $6 billion on research on renewable energies in this country. So we're spending more on potato chips than we spend on research on renewable energies. China spends $9 billion a month on this, on this kind of work. The National Science Foundation is another one, and then up here, the Department of Defense. So we're having a lot of research being done in the area of military and in the area of lighter armor, in the area of better weaponry, surveillance systems, small chemical rockets flying around, and so on and so forth. So the first challenge is the funding environment, because we're really not spending much on how to communicate it. If this is the whole pie of funding, we're spending a very, very small proportion, only about $40 million. And a lot of that's actually going to centers like the one that I am. So we're not spending a lot of money on communication in the first place. Talking to a public that knows little. Number two, the second problem are very low levels of, well, let me go back here. Very low levels of awareness of nanotechnology. And that's something where we as researchers very often say, well, the public doesn't know anything. It's an easy thing to say. And essentially accusing the general public of not knowing much. But the answer is that's really not that different from what we've seen for other technologies. We've seen fairly stable levels. People don't know much. They don't learn much. The problem that we're having is that communication about nanotechnology really doesn't happen in a vacuum. So when we're saying, well, we don't really have to talk about these new technologies because people don't know much, somebody else out there is. Greenpeace is talking about nanotechnology. A lot of environmental defense, Friends of the Earth, they are talking about nanotechnology, and they're talking about a story that says nanotech is dangerous for you. And again, we're talking about a technology where BASF and the large chemicals spend about 80%, 90% of the R&D budget. This one, it will be too small to see, unfortunately. I apologize for this, but this just tells you what, on an average day, people actually pay attention to when they pay attention to the news. This was during the healthcare debate, so this was during a time when really that was, and also Iran and greenhouse gas bill cap and trade were really issues that were high on people's radar. Well, Michael Jackson, of course, outdid this by 2-1 easily. So the problem that we're having with science and technology is that science and technology doesn't get covered in a vacuum. At any given moment, any housewife show or any whatever other reality show is up there right now will actually use up more of the news hole than almost everything else. Let me show you really quickly how we make decisions about our presidents even. So just to put science in the context of where our general public stands, or we in general stand on particular issues. This is during the 2000 election. This is data actually from Harvard, from Tom Patterson's Vanishing Voter Project. And what he did is over the election campaign, he tracked, and this doesn't reflect at all, he tracked over time how much people knew. And this is a very simple question. This is simply saying, do you think Bush is pro or con gun control? If you look at how many people think that he favors stricter gun laws, obviously he doesn't, George Bush, 43, about 1 in 5 say. So good, only 1 in 5 roughly get it wrong. Problem is, only 1 in 5 also get it right, and a vast majority of people really know nothing. I put some pink lines in here. These are the two conventions in the summer. These are the debates. So these are the areas, or these are the time periods when you would hope that people learn more, and they don't. What ends up happening is, yes, that narrows a little bit. The ignorance overall decreases, but ultimately, if you add the blue line and the yellow lines together, 2 out of 3 Americans really don't know that much, or 3 out of 5, rather, don't know even about the most simple issue stances in politics. So we're talking about an American public that ultimately doesn't know much. And they don't even learn much over the course of the campaign. In other words, and this is taken from the healthcare debate, what we're having is we have a large public that's inattentive, and that's not a problem of availability. You can go online and find out anything about nanotechnology, if you want to, right now, or about politics, or about George Bush, or about anybody else, but you don't. The internet makes it easier to find new information, and it makes it even easier to ignore all the information you don't want to pay attention to. And the problem that we're having is, I think the healthcare debate showed this quite nicely, this young lady in one of the healthcare public debates with a picture of Obama as Hitler. People will mobilize, even without knowing much about these technologies. Third challenge, media are going away. Traditional media are no longer with us. Journalism is dead, just to put some big simplistic phrases out here. This is taken from what one of the things that we do as part of the center is we track media coverage. Every piece of coverage that has been written on nanotechnology since the 1960s. And we analyze who has written it, what the topics were, what the themes were. This is the critical one here. There are only 7 journalists in this country who have written more than 25 articles on one of the breakthrough technologies, one of the breakthrough technologies in nanotechnology. The issue that we're having is, so we only have, and I think this is me, I apologize. The issue that we're having is that we only have 7 expert journalists, 2 of whom are no longer with us. Rick Weiss for the Post, left the Post, went to Science Progress, and then Barnaby Fader from the New York Times, left the New York Times, actually went to Divinity School. So of those 7 that we have, we only have 5 expert writers left on that particular issue. And most scientific issues are exactly like this, meaning there are very, very few journalists left. CNN has completely cut their science staff. There is no science staff anymore. In fact, a lot of the writers that you see at the Nieman, among the Nieman Fellows or elsewhere, are people who have left their respective newspapers because there's no news hole anymore for science. So we don't fund a lot of research on connecting with the public. We have few journalists who even cover it. We have a public that doesn't pay attention, and if they do pay attention, they don't learn much. So how do they make sense of technology? How do we all make sense? Because it's not just they somewhere out there, it's us. The basic idea is, and this is true for every single person in this room, faculty member, student, undergrad, grad, doesn't matter, we are all cognitive misers. I'll get my voice now. We're all cognitive misers. We all use as little information as possible, or we try to when we have to make a decision, we try to collect as much as we think we have to make a decent decision. So as little as possible, cognitive miser, and then satisfizer, well, we collect as much as we think we need to. But ultimately, we never make decisions with complete information. When you run into somebody, you look at what they wear, how they talk, what cell phone they have on them, whatever else. You use some shortcut, some heuristic. And we all do it. If anybody claims that they don't, you're lying. You do. And you know that I'm right. So we constantly make decisions without having complete information. Problem is, we know little, and we make decisions based essentially on heuristics and what some people have called low information rationality. In fact, Bill Clinton's campaign advisor, way back when, who is now a professor at UC San Diego, wrote a book. Sam Popkin wrote a book called The Rational Voter, and the argument that he's making is that there is a rationality to not collecting as much information. And this is a bad. I understand this is a bad. Piece of advice to give to students, but ultimately, you will have to learn over the rest of your lives to make good decisions with limited information, and there's a rationality to that. And that's his argument. So most people will not go out and try and understand an issue like nanotech that other people spent 15 years getting a PhD in, and they will say, well, let me get all the scientific complexity. You won't. You won't understand it. You're not trained to understand it. So what you do is you form attitudes in the absence of complete information. Maybe because some website told you, or maybe because some speaker told you that this is good or bad. You will essentially replace information with heuristics, or what people in psychology call heuristics, which are information shortcuts. And especially when an issue is too complex or not easily accessible. What are some of these shortcuts? Number one, it's scientific information. That's certainly a shortcut, that's good. But scientific information is already conveyed to you by some source that you hopefully trust in some way, shape, or form. Scientific information from Scientific American is different than scientific information that you got from some other less trustworthy source, some blog that some guy in a Metallica t-shirt writes in his mother's basement. They're hopefully differences. Other things, other shortcuts. And Jim knows more about this than I do, the idea of cultivation. The idea that our perceptions of reality, for most of us, especially when it comes to science, to issues like crime or other things, are shaped by television. They're shaped by consistent portrayals and over time portrayals of those things. How do we know how a bench scientist works? How do we know how a lab works, a scientific lab? Because we've seen it on TV. Some crime show has had a science lab, and you've seen it. How do we know how psychiatrists or psychologists work? You may have seen Awakenings. How do we know about self-replicating robots? One of the key applications of nano. Building small robots that can self-replicate and build bigger and better robots and more intelligent robots. Terminator 3. That's the only time most of you have ever heard the term nanotechnology, if you've heard it at all. is in entertainment media. So a lot of our understanding of how science and tech works, and controversial science and tech, comes from television. The last one, and this is the most subtle one that I quickly want to talk about, is frames. And frames framing is a really interesting media theory because it says that I can change your perception about any given piece of information simply by presenting it in different ways. That I can take the exact same piece of information and frame it in two different ways. If that's information about evolution and framing it as a war, as a controversy, or if that's the idea of Frankenfood. You may not know much about ag biotech, you may not know much about genetically modified organisms. When I say Frankenfood, you intuitively understand what I'm talking about, because the idea of Frankenfood attaches it to a particular node in your brain. Let me show you how it works. And in fact, in 2002, Dan Kahneman at Princeton won a Nobel Prize for this work. And what he says is, every perception that you have, every observation that you make is not objective. All of you, when you walk out of this room later, will have slightly different interpretations about this talk. You will have remembered different things. You will interpret things differently. Some of you may think it was good. Some others will hate it. Why is that? Did you see a different talk? No. There were different parts of your brain that were activated depending on certain modes of presentations that I used. And what he's saying is every perception, every piece of perception is reference dependent. And it's especially reference dependent when there's an ambiguous stimulus, something that you're not quite sure about. This is an ambiguous stimulus. And so this is taken directly from his Nobel Prize speech. This one could be a B, a letter, or it could be a series of numbers of one and a three. Well, what he did is he assigned people into two experimental groups, and he gave them either this or he gave them this. So in other words, the stimulus, and I should have learned this by now, flat learning curve, the stimulus stays the same, right? I give you the exact same stimulus. I'm asking you, what do you see in the middle here? And of course, everybody here says, I'm seeing a B, and everybody here says, I'm seeing a number. So in other words, the exact same piece of information can mean different things to different people, depending on how it's presented. Why does this matter? It matters because this is what scientific information looks like. This is taken from Reuters in August 2009, talking about multi-wall tarbin nanotubes, saying they can kill people. In fact, in China, just killed two people. Then I read an article in the New York Times that says, hey, multi-wall carbon nanotubes, same thing, actually help curing cancer by developing better early detection methods. So in other words, the same thing may do two completely opposite things. So what is it? Does it kill people? Does it help cure cancer? Depends on how I present the story. And so just to repeat, frames have nothing to do with presenting different information. It means that the same piece of information can be presented in two different ways. I can describe nano, and it has happened in media coverage, that nano, it was described as the next plastic or the next asbestos. Think about this in your brain. If you read an article that describes nano as the next plastic, what do you think? You think about something that will change everything, new applications, and so on and so forth. Next asbestos, you're thinking regulatory processes, lung cancer, and so on and so forth. Remember the bank bailout? That lasted about 2 days, and then it switched over to the rescue package. So the Obama administration quickly realized that nobody wants to bail out the banks, but rescuing the economy was a really good idea. Really, the only mistake for that was that they didn't call it the Bush bailout, which would have been the greatest frame because it would have connected it directly to George Bush, which they, to this day, failed to do politically. But again, simply changing the terminology of a new policy can change how people interpret it. And the way it works is that it's simply a frame or a description resonates with certain parts in your brain. And changing the description or the label means that it resonates with one versus the other. So if it resonates, and this is just repeating what I just showed, if it resonates with certain parts in your brain, then it works, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. More importantly, let me for this one really quickly just give you one last example without trying to run out of time here. But baseball is a great example. We had this conversation before. Jim and I certainly have had this conversation. I didn't grow up in this country. I didn't move here until I was 25. I don't understand baseball. I don't get it. I don't know what an RBI is. I have no idea. And that's just, I think you have to grow up with it. So if you tell me that there's a three strikes and you're out legislation that leads to a federal conviction, I don't even know why there are three strikes and why that makes any sense. Because it's completely culturally specific, if you think about it. Nobody else thinks about three strikes. It doesn't exist in Germany. It doesn't exist cricket may have it. I don't understand that either. But ultimately, if you tell me this, it doesn't. I'm in this group. You give me this description, it doesn't resonate. There's no effect. You give the same description to an American audience, they will completely get it because it's culturally ingrained and they will understand it. So in other words, simply changing a label will help some audiences but not others. To make it even more complicated, and this is taken already, you saw it earlier, maybe I put it up really quickly, it's actually taken from Star Wars. Many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view. And that's in many ways a stupid statement since it's taken from Star Wars, but it actually does make some sense in a research context. And that is that the exact same frame or the exact same description may make a completely different impression on you depending on what your value systems are or your religions. And again, all of you come from different backgrounds. You have different religious views. You have different ideas about what is morally right or wrong. You have different knowledge about various areas. So if I give you the exact same piece of information, depending on what your values are, you will show different effects. So again, the exact same fact that I can put in front of you will produce different outcomes. Let me show you that this one here. We asked people how many benefits they saw to the new technology, nanotechnology. We asked them a whole battery, 8-10 questions. And then we group people into two halves. Either you see a lot of benefits or you don't. So objectively, you see a lot of benefits, you don't. And then we ask them, how supportive are you of the federal government spending more money on this? Again, one of the most highly funded areas of science. And of course, the more benefits you see, the more, hopefully, support you have. And that's true. Except for it's much stronger for people who are less religious than for people who are more religious. So in other words, what happens is not that religiosity undermines support for nano. What happens is that among religious people, when they see benefits, they say, well, I see the benefits, but I don't care. So in other words, you may agree that there's benefits, but ultimately those benefits don't really influence much your attitudes. And you use those as a perceptual filter. That's not good or bad. That simply says, given your value system, you will look at the exact same things differently. Same thing for stem cell. Stem cell research is actually even more extreme. And here, for stem cell, we used knowledge. So we gave people a quiz, objective knowledge quiz, 6 items, saying, you know, do you know, if it's true or false that stem cells can be made from whatever else, I mean, skin cells, umbilical cord. So we gave them a bunch of questions, I can't remember what they are, about stem cells. And then grouped people into people who could answer a lot of them right and people who couldn't. So these are people who score low, failing grade, passing grade. And then we asked them how supportive they were. And this is even more extreme because this one is knowledge. This is not how many benefits do you see, it's what do you know. And what you see is that, again, knowledge matters. The more you know, the more supportive you get for less religious respondents. For more religious respondents, it's a total flatline. It is irrelevant how much they know. They can answer every single question correctly. They can answer 6 questions correctly, and it will still not shape their attitudes. Because they don't see it as an intellectual or scientific problem, they see it as a moral problem or religious problem. And it has that component, certainly. So what we're having with new technologies, and nano is not any different, is that we're having more and more of a scenario where these new technologies so quickly change what we as a society believe is right or wrong, that they very quickly also influence or appeal or don't appeal to underlying value systems. And I think that's going to be one of the things that we'll see more and more of. So what are some of these new opportunities? And I'll try to go through those fairly quickly so we can talk about them a little bit more. The first one is just a repetition of what we saw. And this is where politics is moving. Politics is moving toward an area where a lot of the issues that the Obama administration is talking about, global warming, stem cell, a whole bunch of other issues, nanotech, will be ultimately moral issues. George Bush won the election in 2004 not by convincing anybody that he was a great president, because people didn't think so, or that the war was a good idea, which people also didn't think. He won the election in 2004 by turning out 11 million ultra-conservative voters in Ohio. That's how he won the election. And the next example you will forgive me for because it's a little bit targeted at most of you, and that is Obama. Not any different in 2008. He turned out a lot of 18 through 24-year-old voters who didn't really know much about politics, didn't know much about healthcare, and went right back to their apathetic, non-political lives after the election, which is exactly the problem that Obama is in right now, or that the Democrats are in right now, that grassroots movement is gone. Why does this matter here? It matters here because ultimately it has pushed politics away from a highly informed electorate, 40-50%, into an area of the electorate that makes decisions much more based on other value statements. And stem cells and all these issues feed directly into it, global warming, nanotechnology, and so on. And so what we're seeing more and more is a merging of politics and science. We're seeing, and that is what I showed you, that the exact same facts may translate into different conclusions, attitudinal conclusions. The stem cell example. It doesn't matter how much you know. If you're highly religious, your attitude will stay absolutely the same. So ultimately, for us to understand value systems and how they play into politics and science is absolutely critically important. That's lesson one. Lesson number two is that really data matters more than anything else. We've actually treated science communication and communication about emerging technologies as something that we can do ad hoc, that we leave to the scientists, that we leave to the engineers. They can do some K-12 education efforts. They can, do a few campaigns. So we haven't really used the same logic. What happened as a result is that we've created a two-class society. And you're all lucky because you're in the class that will benefit greatly from what we have. Because you're in the group that has a college degree or will have a college degree eventually, hopefully for most of you, or a graduate degree. This is taken from data that the National Science Foundation, National Science Board collect every other year. How many people go to a science and technology museum at least once a year? A lot of depressing stuff in here. Number one, most highly educated cohort in the US, College Plus. That went up from 35 to 50%. So great, there was an increase. That means half of the most highly educated Americans go to a science and technology museum at least once a year, which is depressing. What's even more depressing is, and this is again the widening gap, is that among people who haven't finished high school, that percentage is at less than 10% and it's not changing at all. So what we're doing in science communication reaches the most highly educated, it doesn't reach the least educated, the ones who need it the most. How does this translate into knowledge? Well, we ask people in national surveys, 6 questions about nano, again, same thing, quiz. What happens? Over time, between 2004 and 2007, you see a widening gap. One group learns, one group acquires information, the other group actually decreases and has less and less information about nanotech. So what we're moving toward is we're moving toward a two-class society where one group of society will benefit from these technologies, will know them better, will make electoral choices that are pro-science, and the other one will make electoral choices that are less supportive of science, or at least that's a likely outcome. And that's a real problem in the US. Again, we're talking about turnout in the US usually between 40 and 60%, and the 60 really being optimistic. So usually about half of Americans just don't even turn out if they can. So the one last thing that I want to leave you with is the silver lining. And this is taken from the exact same data. What we looked at is, we said, let's look at these highly educated and less educated folks one more time. And the blue ones are the highly educated, so that's the group that should increase. And the red ones are the least educated that should decrease, right? Or who should decrease. Those are the two groups that I just showed you. The one group that's in here is this group. And that should actually technically be down here because they're the least educated. But for some reason, they're sitting up there with the highly educated. Why is that? And the only difference is that they're high on internet exposure, that they score high on internet exposure, whatever. So in other words, they increase over time their knowledge. And the only difference that they have is that they actually use the web quite a bit, any type of online scientific information. So there seems to be a real silver lining in terms of what the internet can do. Well, the tricky part is the good news first. Let me give you the good news first. The good news is that you guys are shifting increasingly toward that medium. And you know this. I'm not telling you anything new. I'm just putting up the data really quick. Here's the older folks, the green, all going over to your traditional media diet, newspaper, television. The younger folks toward the red, and even 35 through 44 in there is still older, young, whatever, moving more toward a mixed media or an online-only diet. And that's, again, not new. That's going to change. That's going to change quickly. But where's the tricky part? Well, the tricky part is that really, and this is the last slide that I have, but the tricky part is, and this is the response that I usually get, is there are two types of selectivity that you all engage in, that we all engage in online. Number one is psychological and cognitive. It's basic Festinger, right? Cognitive dissonance. You're less likely to expose yourself to a piece of information that doesn't fit into your belief system. You just are less likely. So if you hear something that you don't like that doesn't fit your belief system, you're less likely to expose yourself to that. Again, there's individual differences and predispositional differences, but that's certainly one. The second selectivity, though, and this is true for most of you, is social. In the 2008 election, 25% of all young voters said that a significant number of their news came from their social network. So in other words, you don't read it in the Post, or you don't read it in the Times, you get it in the news feed of some of your friends. And this is why this is up there, because that's exactly what your friendship network, of course, looks like. And some of you are sitting right here, and some of you are sitting right here. So some of you are very central nodes, very highly in a very dense network, lots of friends. Some of you are more at the margin. Some of you are actually weak ties, connecting networks. And that's something that's not new. This is Paul Lauzenfeld, who in the 1940s came up with the idea of opinion leaders, so the two-step flow of information. That you don't get information from a medium directly, you get information from people that are central in the network, and they pass it along to you. Back then it was newspapers. Today it's Facebook. Not any different. In fact, this is the business model, of course. If you read any article about Facebook or have seen the movie or whatever else, or about social networking more generally, Zuckerberg didn't get sued by ConnectYou.com over an idea. He got sued over a business model. And in that business model, you're not the customer, you're the product. The customer is who's buying data. And those data are, for example, data about Victoria's Secret, about Bank of America, and so on. Victoria's Secret, this is a good example because it's actually their campus ambassador model. What's the campus ambassador model? It says, hey, what we do is we go in, we find the most influential people on campus. Who are these? They're sitting right here. Those are the people. Most of their friends, highly connected to everybody else. It used to be we do this with surveys, now we do it with Facebook and just find them. And then we go and we give them two products, one for them to wear, the other one to give away to friends. So that two-step flow of information. So this was the depressing part, right? This is the good part. Well, whatever. This is Brad Pitt. That came out totally wrong. That's not how I wanted to present this one. Brad Pitt, the good part for the topic that I'm talking about happens to be Brad Pitt. This is, by the way, the first picture that comes up when you Google him and when you image Google him. When California came out with Prop 17, which was about raising federal money, raising private money to get around the Bush stem cell legislation. So when Bush said you cannot use federal money outside of these 40 stem cell lines, California raised private money. And they did this around Prop 17. And the way they did it is exactly through the idea of opinion leadership. They said, we need to reach people who traditionally don't pay attention to stem cell. We know that we're going to get all the liberal academics. We know we're going to get all the business on board. The people we need in an election are the people who don't care and ultimately are not very pro-science. Remember, I showed you earlier that stem cell graph. Well, how did they get them? That by sending Brad Pitt in and saying, and going to Good Morning America or whatever the show was that Katie Couric had at the time, and talking about stem cell. And this goes right back to the idea of framing. He framed the issue around two ways. He said, look, this is A, about social progress, and it's B, about global competitiveness. It's about pushing the society to the next level and about in terms of...
Now, you refer to nanotechnology as controversial science. What exactly about nanotechnology is controversial?
Yeah. Okay. So nanotech is controversial now. The tricky part about nano is, and then I've mentioned this briefly, is that it's an enabling technology, right? So it's this idea that and BASF advertises this, we don't make products, we make products better. And nanotech does exactly that. So what nano does, for instance, and I didn't show you a number of slides, which I skipped for the sake of time, is, and I'm not sure if you followed earlier this year, the debate surrounding JVAC Venter and creating synthetic life in the lab. So the idea of synthetic biology, which brings engineering and medicine to the table. So for instance, it may be possible, or it will fairly soon be possible, to use nanoscaffolding and grow stem cells along. So if I want to, my ear gets ripped off and I want to replace it with Exacta, you have a morbid example, but whatever, and I want to replace it with the exact same ear, I can grow that exact organ harvesting. I have a fairly high chance of at some point having some form of heart disease. Why not grow a heart somewhere that is genetically identical to what I need rather than waiting for a donor heart? So I can grow them. The idea of human enhancement, why do we need to restrict what we do to 2020 science, 2020 vision, if we actually have the means to potentially create eyes artificially and synthetically that are much better than what we currently have. So in other words, when is it therapeutic and when is it enhancement? How far do we want to go? Number two, these silver, nano-silver washing machines that I mentioned in the area now of antimicrobial silver nanoparticles. That means what how silver nanoparticles work is they essentially suffocate bacteria. Very simple. I mean, that's how Band-Aids with silver work. Same idea, except for it's nano-sized. Problem is, that gets into drinking water. Now you ingest it. You have millions of bacteria inside of you that are all very helpful and actually necessary for your survival. Do you want silver nanoparticles in your water? And the answer is you don't. You really don't. And I don't either. But your Brita filter is not going to filter it out. Neither is any current filter. So do we want this? And the problem is we have absolutely no regulatory frameworks in place for this. Let's think about, for example, how we regulate silver nanoparticles. Let me give you a good example. Amazon sells silver nanoparticles at something called Fresher Longer Food Container. They sell it, they say, look, there's nano in there, it's nano silver, it's great, it's going to keep your tomatoes fresher longer in your fridge. And it's antimicrobial. Friends of the Earth at some point then writes to the EPA and says, hey, if you make antimicrobial claims in the US, what you need to do is you need to regulate it under FIFRA. And I'm not sure how many of you know what FIFRA is. It's the Fungicide, Insecticide, Rodenticide Act. So in other words, molds, rats, and insects. That's how we regulate nanoparticles right now, because we don't have any better regulatory infrastructure in place. So the controversy comes in from moral questions surrounding medicine. It comes in from what Amazon did, and I should tell you the end of the story. What Amazon ended up doing in Sharper Image before they went bankrupt is they took the nano label off in the antimicrobial label. So you can still buy the product. It still has nano silver in it, except you don't know anymore, because now if you actually purchase it, it doesn't say. So they don't have to, because if they don't make an antimicrobial claim, they don't have to get regulated. So what you end up having is you end up having IP concerns, you end up having regulatory concerns, you end up having human enhancement concerns, moral concerns, and so on. There's a whole bunch of fronts where right now the discussions are going on. That doesn't include even the military aspects, which I showed you was about a third of all the funding, where DARPA and other military agencies, for instance, talk about the idea of ubiquitous surveillance. So the idea that Lockheed Martin right now is building half-inch-long chemical self-propelled rockets that are remote controlled. And so this is not futuristic. This is being built. They fly around and they talk to each other to essentially create real-time, constant surveillance. Or we drop cluster bombs on certain parts of certain cities. Thousands and thousands of nanotransmitters that are virtually impossible to find with some larger transmitters. And so the whole city becomes one gigantic grid of connections. If you walk around, your steps are being traced simply based on you interrupting the transmission. So in other words, do I go into Baghdad and take satellite pictures every so often or put up cameras or trying to whatever? No, I just dump a bunch of cluster bombs of these nanotransmitters. And all of a sudden, I have perfect surveillance. Let's assume you find 100 of these. You spend a day in picking them up. There's still going to be thousands around that are just going to pick up their connections. So that idea of, or airports, another one, you go through these little blowy thingies, those little, some of you not, so you've been through them. Phoenix has them, apparently. Logan has them, too. And that actually blows into you and ideally loosens bomb-making materials, which is so your real-time sensor if somebody has plastic explosives on them or something. Well, that also works eventually. What they're working on right now is it loosens enough skin particles that if you wanted to, you could actually real-time DNA test people. So instead of, I mean, foreigners like me, we come into the country, we do the little finger and little, you know, iris shot and whatever. Well, why not just give it a little blow and you can immediately, right there, skin loosens and you can do real-time DNA testing. Again, do we want this? No, I'm not sure. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just saying that certainly raises some issues. So there's the interesting thing about nano is that it literally is all in every aspect of life. It's in medicine, it's in weaponry, it's in clothing, it's in food. Food safety is a big one. Changing the nature of food. So for example, bacon. You want low fat bacon, but you still want it to be really greasy. Put a layer of nano coating on top, so it still feels greasy, but it's better for you. One possibility. I mean, that's not a possibility. That's your reality. So that you actually coat food with certain types of coating. Do you want it? Up to you. But then there's of course labeling concerns. So long answer. But I mean, there's 50,000 connections to where it is a controversial issue.
Other questions over here?
You said you're talking about how the public is
We've actually been working quite a bit with the Boston Science Museum. Actually has a spearheads a $12 million effort called NISNET, Nanoscale Informal Science Education Network. And they've developed essentially a what they call a roadmap, and that roadmap is what should people know. And instead of one thing, they talk really about four different things. So one is the size, how small it really is, because that's important. For example, it can cross the blood-brain barrier and so on. So it's number one, size. It's number two, the idea that it's completely novel qualities. So we're creating a material that hasn't existed in nature before yet, potentially at least. Number three, it's the idea that those novel qualities have risks and benefits. And number four is an understanding of where the applications can be. So kind of the last answer that I gave. So those are the four that they're saying are really the important ones. Size, and then novel properties, risk benefits, and then the applications. And I think that's kind of, those are the four facts that are really, from a policy perspective, the most important ones. Because like, look, you're gonna use these things. You are using these things actually right now. If you have a nano squash racket, which I own, for instance, right now you don't wanna sand it down, you just don't. I mean, how many people sand down their squash racket? But you do not wanna do this given the materials that are in there. And then kind of these new properties, because they will require new EPA, FDA regulations and so on. But those are the four. So I don't have one, but those are the four.
Do you think that science and entertainment media, like the Terminator movie, is detrimental to the accuracy that we're receiving, or do you think that it's good in building interest in the topic?
Well, I think in principle, it's very good in building interest in the topic. We just finished a thing with a project with the National Academies of Engineering, where we looked at the U.S. has a serious problem with females and minorities not going into engineering or more broadly STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and medicine fields. And the U.S. is behind. We're like 46th or something on a ranking. And again, this is the U.S. Compared to other countries. So there is a real recruitment problem, actually, in getting interest in general into some of these. And so we did a project where we looked at K-12 and interviewed students in K-12, and looked at some of the incentives and images of what scientists, and Jim has done work on this, of what scientists look like, of what the endeavor of science is, and so on. Is a huge predictor, and that comes to a large degree from entertainment television or from entertainment media. The problem is that what raises interest, or the most interesting stories, are not the most accurate ones. I mean, we know that, right? That's just how politics is covered. I think John Stewart at some point said, "Who wants to watch a truck not on fire?" Right? And so that's kind of the idea. So the truck on fire is just objective to the more interesting story. And the same thing, science going wrong. And if you, there's some really horrible movies out about nanotechnology, really horrible BC movies that run on Sci-Fi Channel on a regular basis. And they're just, of course, it's interesting to see self-replicating robots and swarms of gray goo that eat people up. Or that comic book that I showed you earlier, actually, a student of mine did a study of nanotechnology and comic books. And people getting eaten up from the inside by nanobots and whatever else. That's a great storyline, it's great visuals and so on and so forth, but it's not accurate. So what the National Academies has tried to do is they have this partner program where they match up scientists as scientific advisors on movies to hopefully do both. So in other words, make an interesting movie that's still as scientifically accurate as possible. I'm not sure how well that's gonna work out. We'll see. But I think that's the problem with entertainment, not television, but all entertainment media. It has the potential to raise interest and awareness, but at the same time, a good storyline is not a scientific one. A scientific one is just a boring storyline. I mean, just be honest, bluntly honest here. Mm-hmm.
When you're working with people or trying to target people who already have established beliefs, how do you work around that? Or is it you just don't even try to write to those people anymore?
Yeah, I'll give you a cynical answer first, and then I'll give you a non-cynical one. So the cynical answer is a political one, and that is, if I have to win an election or get a policy through, I do everything based on a normal curve, right? So if I'm Barack Obama, the ultra-right I'm not going to get. If I'm George Bush, the ultra-left, I'm not going to convince Barbara Streisand that I'm a good president. It's just not going to happen. And so, in other words, what you do is you push it as far to the, in politics, that's exactly how it works, right? You push it as far across the middle of the normal curve as you have to. So in other words, if you're Clinton, you're as conservative as you can be as a Democrat in order to pick up enough middle class voters. Same thing for Obama, same thing for Mitt Romney or whoever else is going to run next time on the Republican side. And I think for science, there is some truth to that. Some people you just won't reach. I'm not going to convince some people that stem cell research is a good idea. I just won't. It's just not going to happen. And those people I'm going to just write off. And I don't need them in order to get certain policies passed. We're talking about... And for some of them, it's a bit more complicated because for certain things you need a 60 vote majority in the Senate, but let's assume we can live with about 50. The more concrete answer actually comes out of that last slide that I showed you, and this is, I think, where a lot of the real hope lies. It's when Victoria's Secret or Bank of America does it, it's kind of creepy, I think, personally, in terms of campus ambassadors. And of course, they know that you trust your friends more than most other sources. That's the point of campus ambassadors, that if you see an advertisement, it's not going to work as well. But the beauty of that, of course, of Facebook is also that it allows me that we're switching actually from a model where I'm targeting populations by segments. I'm no longer talking about 18 through 22-year-old males in urban settings. I'm talking about you. I know what you bought. I know your credit cards. I know everything about you pretty much. I know who you're friends with. I know whose pictures you looked at. I know who you chatted with. I know whose comments you liked. I know whose comments you looked at for how long. I know who you defriended and refriended and whatever you did. So I have gigantic databases about you that I'm matching up very easily with a bunch of social security numbers and zip codes. And everything else that you do. HTML5, by the way, with super cookies will be even easier. So in other words, it's really creepy in certain ways, but for this, it's perfect. A colleague of mine, for instance, at NC State, at some point didn't have enough people for his grad seminar at NC State, North Carolina State. And so what he did is he bought essentially a profile on Facebook. So give me everybody in NC State that has some interest in this, has mentioned this under their interest, and essentially sent out an ad for his class and filled his seminar. Very easy to do. A little bit weird if you have to send out Facebook ads to fill your classes, that's a different issue. But ultimately, it shows you the point of what you can do. And so ultimately, the targeting for certain groups of people, if I really have a problem with a certain segment, where I think, asking to the question earlier, what do they need to know? Well, different segments need to know different things. So if I really want to have a very targeted type of campaign, that's more possible now than it's ever been. So there's good news to that as well. I think there's an upside to that, as creepy as it is. I'm old enough to just think it's creepy, period. For me, that's just, but I'll die out and you guys take over. And then that'll be that. I think there's a huge potential there in terms of really going after people based on, even down to what the reason why Gmail gives you more gigabytes of space than anybody else is because they real-time content analyze your messages, right? So the ads that are being targeted toward you are based on what you wrote. That's the idea. It's real-time content analyzing. So if I know that somebody has certain exchanges, put certain things on their blogs, that's how I target the ads. That's what AdSense is all about. That's what Google's business model is all about. So there's always the creepy side to it, but there's also the huge potential to actually targeting exactly toward conversations that I think, and then actually the National Academies of Engineering report that I mentioned earlier about children and engineering was actually called Changing the Conversation. That was actually the title of the talk, the title of the report that we put out around exactly that. So the cynical one is I'm ignoring a whole bunch of people, and the concrete one is, for those who I don't ignore, I have better tools than I've ever had to actually target them if I'm willing to do it, and willing to do it right based on data.
So the nice thing is, for those of you that were updating your Facebook statuses or using Gmail, as here, we're analyzing all that data right now. So we'll get back to you. I would tell Dietram he hit a home run with his talk, but he doesn't know what that means. offended the Star Wars fans, but that's okay. So let's thank you.
Sorry, Jim.
This has been a Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. For more information about the Communication Research Center, please go to www.bu.edu/com/crc. Thank you.